This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, deadly shootings by and of police in America. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Americans are still reeling from last week's violence in which police shot and killed two African-American men at point-blank range, Alton Sterling in Louisiana and Philando Castile in Minnesota. Then, later in the week, toward the end of a peaceful Black Lives Matter protest against the deaths of these two black men, five white police officers were shot and killed by Micah Johnson, an Army Reserve Afghan war veteran who reportedly was angry over these police shootings and stated that he wanted to kill white people, especially white police officers. The killings of the black men are the latest incidents in a string of shootings in the United States in what is widely viewed as examples of police using excessive force against minorities. And the attack by a black Army veteran on five white police officers in Dallas only intensifies the national debate over racial bias in law enforcement. At a memorial service for the slain police officers in Dallas, President Barack Obama both defended and honored the Dallas policemen who ironically were protecting a peaceful Black Lives Matter protest when they were tragically gunned down. But he also said that even though race relations have improved dramatically in America in recent decades, racial bias in America remains.
And so when African Americans from all walks of life, from different communities across the country, voice a growing despair over what they perceive to be unequal treatment, when study after study shows that whites and people of color experience the criminal justice system differently, so that if you're black, you're more likely to be pulled over or searched or arrested, more likely to get longer sentences, more likely to get the death penalty for the same crime. When mothers and fathers raise their kids right and have the talk about how to respond if stopped by a police officer, yes, sir, no, sir, but still fear that something terrible may happen when their child walks out the door, still fear that kids being stupid and not quite doing things right might end in tragedy. When all this takes place more than 50 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, we cannot simply turn away and dismiss those in peaceful protest as troublemakers or paranoid. We can't simply dismiss it as a symptom of political correctness or reverse racism.
That was President Barack Obama addressing a memorial service in Dallas, Texas. Well, for more on the underlying problems that led to the recent shooting of two black men and five white police officers in Dallas, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Sam Fullwood is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, where he analyzes the influence of national politics and domestic policies on communities of color across the United States. And Anthony Cook, he's a professor at Georgetown Law School and also the author of the book The Least of These: Race, Law, and Religion in American Culture. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Carol.
Great to be here. Thanks, Carol.
Well, Sam Fullwood, let me start with you. I failed to mention that you're a very well-known journalist as well. Let's talk first about the killings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling. President Obama has suggested that the killings of these two black men and others before them may be symptomatic of a broader set of racial disparities in our criminal justice system. Your take?
I don't think there's any question that they reflect disparities in the criminal justice system, but I think there's something else that's a little bit larger than just policing or criminal justice. In both cases, neither of these men were into the real guts of the legal system. That is, they weren't in court. They hadn't been charged with anything. They were stopped by the police. And the police, I think, from what we can tell from media reports, grossly, in both cases, overreacted. And I think that gross overreaction of police officers, particularly in communities of color across the country, is a reflection of our unfinished business with race in this society. I think that the police have a difficult job, and for the most part, they do it admirably. But circumstances arise where police, particularly those who may not be as well trained as they need to be, are confronted with a tense situation, and some baser instincts fall out. That is, they are immediately struck with some kind of primal fear of black people that lead them to overreact, that overrides their training or their limited amount of training. And I think, based on what I can tell from media accounts, that was the situation with both of these shootings.
Professor Anthony Cook, I'd like to get your take on that.
I think Sam's absolutely correct. You know, there is a history here that's much more pervasive than the simple snapshot of these two gentlemen being killed by police officers. You know, we live in a society in which in 2015, there were 1,000, basically, killings by police officers of civilian population. And of that 1,000, black people were, you know, 3 to 4 times more likely to be shot and killed. Black people or black men only constitute 6% of the nation's population, but yet they are 40% of those who were killed without arms. They weren't armed. And so while you do have a situation where if you take that 1,000, it's true that a majority of those who were shot and killed were white, black people are being disproportionately killed. So it's really a tale of two cities. We do have some problems with regard to a certain segment of law enforcement that's long overdue with regard to analysis and correctives. It impacts white people, Asian people, Hispanic people, as it impacts black people. But also, black people are disproportionately, by a significant stretch, impacted by this criminal justice system when it comes to the use of lethal force, when it comes to being targeted and profiled and stopped and frisked and thrown up against a wall or handcuffed and mistreated. They are disproportionately impacted by all these practices. And we've got to be able to tell both of those stories and to not shy away from either one of them.
And of course, then we have this horrific retaliatory act by Micah Johnson, Sam Fulwood. Now, again, he doesn't represent anybody but himself. He's obviously deranged. We see another factor here, potentially, veterans coming back who are perhaps suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. They have access to weaponry. They have the knowledge how to use them. And this man obviously had reached a certain point of ultimate despair. It does not in any way justify what he did, a horrific act. But again, here we go to the other extreme.
The Dallas shooting is something that is almost Shakespearean in its tragic twist of an already very, very bad story. I don't know that there are very many lessons that we can learn from Micah Johnson that will be transferable to any other situation. This is a guy who obviously had some problems, and it is exacerbated by the time that it happened compared to all of the other events and some of the statements that we hear about him, the racial statements that he made. There is a lot of sickness among some segments of our populations, and the prevalence of guns with mental illness makes that sickness Shakespeareanly tragic.
No question. Anthony Cook.
When Black Lives Matter and other organizations for years, even before Black Lives Matter, tried to draw attention to the kind of disproportionate impact that African Americans in particular were feeling within this criminal justice system, you know, they often became the object of ridicule and derision, of being the spokespersons for reverse racism, so forth and so on. But this is part of the problem in the discourse. I'm really interested, you see, in understanding institutionalized racism, systemic racism, from the perspective of how narratives get constructed, of who matters and who does not, who's valued more and who is not. Of course, the loss of these police officers was absolutely tragic. And, you know, we should take a moment to reflect on that and all the things that President Obama said. I was in complete agreement with it. But here are the realities. While 1,000 people are killed by police officers every year, as I said, with the rate of killings being much more drastic for African Americans than for any other group, only 70 officers on average per year are killed. And most of those officers are killed as a result of showing up on a crime scene where there's already shooting and stuff like that, and they get caught in crossfire. Only 20% of the, on average, 70 officers that are killed as a result of being ambushed, being assaulted directly and intentionally. You know, I'm going to kill you because you're an officer. They get caught up in the line of their duty, and things happen when that happens. But yet, you would think from the way the last few days have you know, transpired, that this is a problem that is as pervasive as the problem of Blacks, Hispanics, and even poor whites being the victims of police shootings and killings in American society. The FBI has been keeping these records since 1945, and on average, they average around 70 police killings a year. That's compared to, as I said, 1,000 in 2015. In 2016, we're already at over 500. We may break 2015's record. This is a problem that affects us all, but we've got to be very careful, I think, and attuned to the asymmetries that exist. That the history of American slavery, segregation, mass incarceration, and the continued discrimination against certain segments of our population has resulted in forms of implicit bias, forms of very overt actions of discrimination, and in many instances, we don't want to be guilty of comparing apples to oranges. We need a strategy that deals with both sets of problems.
Well, speaking of a strategy, Sam Fullwood, we know that President Obama has been bringing together law enforcement officials, civil rights leaders, activists, and political leaders to discuss ways to restore trust in communities where there are these tensions between the police and the residents that they're sworn to protect. Do you know if anything's going to come of this? I mean, are we at a watershed moment? If this is not one, I don't know what is.
You know, everybody's asking that question right now, and I don't think that there's any way to know it until after we have actually crossed the Rubicon to know and look back. At any one point in this sort of continuum of activities is a watershed. We don't know what the tipping point is. I mean, I would have thought the tipping point might have been Michael Brown, mm-hmm. or it might have been Trayvon Martin. That apparently was not it. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what is to come next. So my years of reporting stories has sort of trained me not to say definitively that, okay, because of this and because of a president's statements, now the country is poised to do something different.
Indeed. On the other hand, and we've been talking about with you gentlemen at these microphones, what specific steps can be taken? Everybody talks about community policing. That is, we have too many white police officers in predominantly black neighborhoods, which already causes tensions. Mm-hmm. So to what extent are we going to see changes in that regard? Look at the Dallas Police Department, supposedly a model for the country. We have a black police chief. They were making progressive changes. And here, you know, the target of a
yes.
of a madman. So there's community policing, and then there's the question of guns, which is a very volatile topic, as you know. We've been trying to pass legislation that is common sense safety reforms legislation, and we can't even seem to do that.
Look, the Dallas Chief of Police has conducted himself, I think, quite admirably. On the whole, and his statements have been really quite judicious, constructive, and helpful. There are a few things that I disagree with completely, particularly with regard to his advice to protesters to stop protesting because you're not part of the solution somehow and come and become a police officer so you can be part of the solution. But here are the things concretely that I think will move us farther along in dealing with these issues. One, I've seen studies that would suggest that although when you become a police officer, you enter into this kind of sphere where you are socialized and acculturated and you stand behind the shield, you put on the blue, and everybody is assimilated to that, wanting to protect their own. That definitely happens, right? But it's interesting that even within that socializing phenomenon, women and other minorities who are police officers are less likely to draw their arms. When they draw their arms and discharge them, they're less likely to discharge with an eye toward killing as opposed to incapacitating. And so there is something in that with regard to the presence of more women and minorities in the police force, policing communities of people of color in particular, that I think will be helpful. Now, is that a be all and end all? Of course, it is not. One of the nice things about the police chief in Dallas is that he grew up in a community, went to college, UT, comes back, sees all of his friends on crack, whole despair of that situation, goes back and decides, I'm going to become a police officer. And by happenstance, happens to go back to the community in which he was raised. People knew him. He knew people. Right. There was a trust factor there, right? We need to be able to recruit more police officers who can not only serve, but who hopefully can be incentivized to live in the communities that they police, because that creates the kind of trust that I think that begins to deal with in a more effective way implicit biases, jumping the gun, and situations that escalate crisis to the point of someone losing their life.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Anthony. I think that goes to the point that I was making very early. Our policing model is one of outsiders coming to contain a community. That has to change. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know exactly what kind of legal mechanism needs to be put in place to change that. In some communities, police officers have to live in the community, at least in the broader geographic area that they're policing, if not the community itself. But I think that's a step in the direction. I think having a more diverse police force, but also the training that changes the culture of what policing is all about. Policing cannot be containing a community. It has to be cooperating with that community. And I don't think that that's what we have at present. You mentioned guns, and I want to come back to that. I think the gun culture in the United States stands alone in the world, and that gun culture contributes to some of this. Police officers are authorized to carry guns, and they have a cowboy mentality. Even the best of them have a cowboy mentality that the gun provides them a measure of authority, that they can go into a community, and because they're armed, they both have to protect themselves and they can impose their will on that community. Now you're seeing in places, particularly like Dallas, where the citizenry are armed. And that is just a crazy, crazy notion.
Something called open carry.
Open carry.
Explain this, Anthony Cook. Even for me, an American, it just seems excessive. People are protesting Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. but they're carrying arms openly.
See, the NRA and their spokespersons have long argued that the answer, the solution to the problem, is not to reduce arms and guns on the street, is to have more. And you hear them say, and Donald Trump has said this as well, had the citizens of San Bernardino in that situation been armed, then the person who was crazy and comes in shooting, they would have been able to neutralize him much earlier. The same is true, they argue, of theaters, of student campuses, and throughout America. This is the logic that they are perpetrating. But, you know, we know that the psychologies and emotions surrounding gun control, with varying levels of emotional stability and competency, so forth and so on, just simply does not work that way. More people who have guns create greater volatile situations that police officers and people of reason are never going to be able to effectively deal with. And so you're going to have more tragedies, not less tragedy. But because the NRA and the culture that is put in place through massive fundraising and, you know, giving monies to politicians, so forth and so on, has really created a warped logic with regard to the Second Amendment, with regard to the rights of individuals to carry and to bear arms. And there is no ending point. There's no logical stopping point to this. People should be able to carry guns everywhere, in churches, in civic organizations, on the streets. It's a return, as you said, to the Wild Wild West in its most graphic and most cruel and inhumane of forms. It doesn't work.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Sam Fullwood, he's Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Anthony Cook, from whom you just heard, he's Professor at Georgetown Law School. We're examining the ramifications of a recent spate of deadly violence by and against police officers in the wake of killings in Louisiana, Minnesota, and Dallas, Texas. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to a loyal fan, Bala Musa from Port Harcourt in Rivers State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Sam Fullwood. To continue our discussion, this is a presidential election year, and of course, this is a topic. You have those very defensive of police officers, There also happened to be maybe more pro-gun or anti-gun legislation or gun safety legislation against those who are maybe more skeptical, wary of police, particularly minorities and those who have been unjustly or disproportionately targeted, and those who probably would like to see greater gun safety laws in place.
Politics really makes this all the more difficult to unravel and to actually get anything done. This is an election year, a presidential election year. I don't believe that this incident has any profound impact on the eventual outcome of it, but it makes it difficult because it hardens people's positions. What this incident does is that it allows the candidates to politicize a tragedy. It allows them to use their talking points, either pro or con, on guns or crime or race or whatever it might be, and to sort of try to harden their bases and their likely voters. I don't think that serves us very good as a society, because what we really need to do is to soften people's attitudes so that we can find some compromises about trying to solve the problem.
Anthony Cook, to what extent do you think the fact that we have a presidential election and we have Donald Trump on the one hand, while lamenting the deaths of the black men, but also coming down very strong with respect to the importance of police officers and honoring the police officers and talking about dangers that they face every day? And then, of course, you have Hillary Clinton talking about the need for better techniques, de-escalation, better training, more community policing, that we have to have a national leadership, and also decrying the flaws in our criminal justice system.
Sure. Look, I think there are severe limits to the role of law as an instrument of social reform. And even when we think that law and judicial decision-making, law through the courts and the Supreme Court, have represented the abilities to serve as a catalyst for social transformation, when we look very closely at Brown v. Board of Education or the fight for equality of marriage, it's really been the people behind it, civil society, right, organizing sometimes for many years, sometimes for decades, to really, you know, change mindsets, mobilize people, and to really impact the political system in order to facilitate some transformative change.
Well, speaking of civil society, back to you, Sam Fulwood, because that brings to mind the Black Lives Matter movement, which sprang up a few years ago, again, in the wake of too many deaths, black men. Now they're under attack. Some say that all lives matter or blue lives matter, basically saying that that's racist to say that. But again, they sprang up as a reaction to the fact that disproportionately too many blacks have been mistreated. You have this sort of back and forth now.
Absolutely. And that speaks to what I'm talking about, the politicization of it. Black Lives Matter is being vilified by conservative forces who would prefer to imagine that none of this happens. And that when you speak about racial disparities, you are in some way reverse racism against white Americans. That is a complete distortion of the reality of what's going on. And it makes it very difficult to have rational conversations when people are completely distorting the reality of a situation. There's no way that anyone can see the Black Lives Movement as being any kind of reverse racist moment. It sprang up in the wake of some very sensational shootings, Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown, and they're drawing attention to the disparities that Anthony talked about. People don't want to look at that. They don't want to deal with that. Because when you look at those disparities, it begs for an answer. It begs for some kind of systemic policy address. And rather than to have that conversation, you vilify the people who are pointing out the problem. And I think that's what we've seen with the reaction to Black Lives Matter.
Your take now, especially Anthony Cook, because, you know, what's going to become of the movement? You know, how will they go on from here?
I mean, Frederick Douglass once said, there is no progress without agitation. With regard to your question of where do we go from here with regard to these movements, Black Lives Matter, they've got to say the heck with the critique. And the gist of it is to say that, you know, we are going to continue to fight this. This is not a seasonal political episodic kind of a thing. We're in this for the long run. We're holding both political parties to account on this.
And on that important note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Sam Fulwood. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Anthony Cook. He's professor at Georgetown Law School. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wagner Roberts, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.